discussion about the new GDLE program and the overarching issues associated with it, the work that's been done to work towards a solution. I'm very pleased to be joined by board members Vonda Scardazzini, Bruce Tonkin, Rita Roden-Johnson, Steve Crocker, and Suzanne Wolf, who I think you all know. Just as a point of housekeeping, I'm going to apologize in advance that Vonda and Steve will have to leave after the start of the session as they have another meeting to go to, but we valued their participation even for a limited time that we're pleased that they could join. Can I have the first slide? So after a brief introduction, we're going to operate on the level that most of the people in the room are knowledgeable of the applicant guidebook and the issues surrounding the introduction of new TLDs. And so after a brief introduction by me, for each of the four overarching issues, economic studies, root zone scaling, trademark protection, and mitigating malicious conduct, we will have an opportunity for members of the audience to comment on the work that's been done to date and if there are opportunities for specific changes that need to be made in the guidebook in order to fully address the issue. We'll take that on board. The purpose of having the board members here with us today is for them to personally interact with the community, listen to comments, and take that back directly to the board discussions on the next steps for the new GTLD process. So we see that as very valuable. Can I have the next slide? So very briefly, the four issues to be discussed that were raised after the publication of the first guidebook have to do with ensuring the continued stability and security of the root zone, undertaking economic studies to determine what the potential benefits and costs of the new GTLE program are, addressing the concerns of trademark owners regarding registrations and protection of trademarks at the top level and, importantly, at the second level. And finally, with the multiplication of TLDs, how do we work to ensure that malicious conduct doesn't multiply similarly or even reduce it? And so I should be the slide master here, huh?
Yeah.
So our overall approach on this has been to take input, seek consultations from those who commented on the guidebook, form expert groups such as the IRT and SDI form trademark solutions, publish those findings, iterate it through public comment, and then develop a set of solutions either for the guidebook or in some cases, you know, in support of launching the process. And it's very important going forward, I think, that we implement the proposed solutions and then measure their impact so that we can continue to improve on the solutions that have been developed. And I'm not going to go through this really, but how do we measure impacts? We look at the policy goals and the goals set out in the affirmation of commitments for the new GTLD program, and we'll measure the effectiveness of these four measures against them. So we're going to start. We have 2 hours for four issues, so not much time, and we really want to hear from you. So with regard to root zone scaling, there's been collaboration and consultation among and with the RSAC, SSAC, and a team formed especially for this purpose, the RSST. We've published documents around root zone scaling, one having to do with a specific instance of the L root and, you know, using that as a model for the root zone. What are the impacts to L root operations with the introduction of new TLDs? Another report reported on the delegation rates that are anticipated with new GTLDs. How many and how fast are we going to delegate TLDs? That report indicated, you know, 200 or 300 TLDs a year and a maximum in any case, even if we were to get infinitely many applications of 1,000 a year. And then there's another report that was staff generated with outside expertise, a summary of impacts to root zone scaling. So what's the status of this is the following. One of the concerns with root zone scaling was that we'd have the coincident introduction of IPv6, IDNs, the signing of the root zone DNSSEC, and new GTLDs, and not necessarily overtaken by events, but so far we do have three of those, right? IDN delegations, IDN delegations, IPv6 deployment in some cases, and assigned root zone. I'm going to turn this discussion over to Steve Crocker and Suzanne, but the fact that delegations will be rate limited is very important to the discussion. The fact that delegation rates will not exceed 1,000 per year. So I'm going to ask Steve to very briefly talk to this issue, and then we can take questions regarding where we think the status of the root zone stability issue is right now. So if you don't mind, Steve.
I'm on. Oh, now I'm on. Kurt, thank you very much. And I think you covered the ground quite well, so I'll try not to repeat any of the things that you said and just try to emphasize and add small points. The original scope was at a time when there was much less information, and now we're over time we have bounded the problem considerably. The route has gotten signed, and DNSSEC, the impact of DNSSEC is now pretty well visible, which, and fortunately, it's essentially negligible. And Suzanne can comment even more knowledgeably about it all. We also, as Kurt has said, now have much better handle on what the likely load is, as seen from sort of the marketing end of this, how many applications are going to come in, and even if large numbers of applications come in, how many are going to reach the next stage and put any load on the root server system. Two things that I think are worth emphasizing here. One is that despite the fact that this has been kind of an extended and a little bit messier process than we had envisioned, it's been a fundamentally constructive process with parties talking to each other more substantively and more often than they had previously, and that's set the tone for continued kind of conversations of the kind that I think are the usual and ordinary interactions between one side of the process that's generating load and the other side that has to deal with it. The other is that this estimate or figure of not to exceed 1,000 per year is the picture now and will persist for some period of time, but obviously doesn't characterize the indefinite future. So I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but let's say that that's a 2 or 3 or 4 year picture as opposed to a 10 or a 50 year picture. A point that is that has been discussed a lot but maybe isn't going to come out as clearly in all of the documentation is that there's no intention of taking these numbers as lasting forever. There is a very strong understanding that there has to be a revisiting and a recalibration and a measurement and observation process baked into this. As I say, all of this is fundamentally constructive and for what it's worth, I'm sleeping quite well at night. Suzanne, you want to?
Sure. I can add just a couple of points for emphasis, just because I believe Kurt and Steve have mostly covered the ground. But one, there's two other sort of minor takeaway points here. One is that it is really hard to overstate the usefulness since the initial root scaling questions were formed of the thought and discussion that just went into scoping what questions we were really asking and to having the worked example of the DNSSEC rollout in front of us. You know, we have this demonstration case at this point, and a great deal of it was public. You know, the detail, a great deal of operational detail is fully public around how the DNSSEC rollout was done. and the cooperation, you know, the day-to-day collaboration amongst the parties involved to make sure that this proceeded in an orderly, predictable, stable way, and that there was no issue of damage or unpredictability to the system. The other thing I think that came out of this inquiry is that in addition to the fact that we do, in fact, do well with managing the operational side of things, there is an additional recognition that we can do better and some discussion and some recommendations regarding closer monitoring and more specific data to be shared among the parties and to be shared publicly about exactly how the system is functioning and how things are performing and what stability looks like, what a robust functioning root system looks like. So I think both the RSAC statement that came out and frankly, I believe the SAC statement that's imminent look very brief and simple, but in fact they represent a great deal of thought and work and commitment to a system that works and to making it work even better.
Thanks very much. So we're going to pause here and ask people to come to the microphone if on this issue there's specific questions or requests for further work.
Thank you very much.
Wait. So maybe some more action here. With regard to economic studies, significant work has been done here, but the work is widely discussed. At different times, ICANN has contracted with Compass Lexicon, Dennis Carlton, Greg Rostin, Michael Katz, Charles River Associates to provide economic studies. Also, studies have been conducted independently by Gandhi in 2009, I think, and 2007, and OECD back in 2004 have furnished studies on the utility and potential net benefits of expansion of the root zone. And so these documents all discuss the benefits and costs of new GTLDs. They portray the benefits and costs differently. Is there going to be competition in the very generic space? What is the value of restricted TLDs, for example, or IDNs? What are the costs associated with trademark protection? What are costs associated with switching from one TLD to another? There's been two specific reports done on whether new TLDs should have price caps for their prices, and there were also two reports on whether there should be a structural or organizational separation between registrars, whether that structure should be maintained or relieved in some way. So several economic studies have been done. I think Elaine Purvis did a great job reading each one of these studies into the record in the session earlier this morning, but they all have to do with these different topics. So it's for the audience here, I want to note that given the comment in the meeting so far here in Columbia that the economic studies posted for public comment, so we've opened up a public comment period on it. Seeking the answer to these questions maybe or other questions, but I invite people to come to the microphone, give their comments on any of the economic studies that have been published, utility of more work, or what can we reasonably expect from economic studies, and how should they be or should not be a gating issue for new GTLDs, or how should they affect the guidebook? So specific comments about the studies with specific recommendations. And then going forward, as we launch new GTLDs, how should impacts of the program be measured, and how should we utilize the expertise of economists in that field in order to describe whether or not we've realized the benefits or mitigated the costs, and how that can be done better? So how do we measure this going forward? So if anybody wants to come to the microphone, I'd be pleased.
Thank you. Would you, my name is Marilyn Cade, would you go back to, if you could, to the slide that has the list of the economic reports on it?
Mm-hmm. I did.
Those are economic reports. Some of them may be studies. Most of them are economic reports. There is really a significant difference. I guess I should say, first of all, that as someone who has hired a number of economists, might even have fired a few, in my history in working for a large corporation, I have a really, I think, in-depth understanding of the role of economic analysis, studies, reports, and policy and views about how both economic theory and facts can inform policymaking. Some of these reports are actually do actually include analysis, and others do not actually include fact-based gathering of information within the use of domain names, how domain names are registered and how they are used, and why people register or unregister domain names. And I want to make that point because I spent extensive time in talking to an economic firm in helping them to deepen their understanding of this particular, I might call it, sector. Mm-hmm. It's not, doesn't deal with potato chips, doesn't deal with cars, doesn't deal with cosmetic products. It deals with something that is in a managed space. And that is very different than a consumer product, which is directly interchangeable with another consumer product. So my point in saying some of these are reports, they may all provide information, not all of them are actually based on studies of the actual registration and use of the present base of domain names, which would, of course, include the vast number of domain names that are registered in country codes, as well as in ASCII-based TLDs. So I'm pleased to see that in this second phase of the of this report just published on Friday, that we're beginning to get to something that I called for quite a long time ago, and I want to thank you all for that, and that is to look at actual use. It's called case studies in here. I might have a slightly different enhanced expectation, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But I think we're beginning to look at the real experience of registrants and beginning to say, so what are the things we can learn from what's going on right now? One of the things that I would say today is an anomaly, and I'm not going to give you my forecast on how long that will continue to be, but it is in the future, and that is the concept of switching cost. That is not a reasonable expectation for trademark holders who have invested their identity around a particular name. You don't switch from your present identity easily. You will have to coexist. And perhaps a better analogy for many of us would be to think about the need to have coexistence, for instance, of IPv4 networks and IPv4 numbers, and IPv6 for quite a long time to come. It will take a long time before someone who has built up a significant identity, registered trademarks in vast, in high numbers and in multiple countries, and built a presence both physically in the brand recognition space and the marketplace, and virtually, to ever be able to abandon a name. They will also have to worry about ongoing efforts to capture the traffic or to cyber squad on the goodwill that exists in that previous name. So I think we really have to think about coexistence cost as opposed to switching cost. Now, perhaps in the future, after search has been replaced by something else. And we think rather than speak or write. We won't have to worry about this, but I can't forecast the time, and I don't think any economist could. We must understand that in order to really, there's some new information in this study, and I would say that we must have a comment period, so I thank you for opening one. But we learned some things in here that have been alluded to before, but we haven't learned everything we need to know. And I think that's an important point as well. But one of the things we learned is that it is very expensive to register and protect a brand, and that it is about users. Users have certain expectations of an identity they find on the internet. They associate either quality or lack of quality with particular brands, and they also have expectations sometimes that there is that brands are trusted. And so let me give you an example of what a consumer might believe. This may not be a trademark brand, but it is certainly a brand. Registrations in .gov are restricted to government agencies only. And a consumer accessing a name expects that to be a U.S. government agency. That is a consumer expectation. I think we've got to begin to look more at what the consumer expectations are and understand what the implications are then for what the intellectual property protection devices must be in order not to harm the consumer. We've been talking a lot about not harming the registry or the registrar. We need to also think about the fact that we're here to offer choice to registrants, not to build registries as businesses. The two will probably go hand in hand. And I think this study begins to point out we need to talk more to the people who have to, for whatever reason, maintain those big portfolios. So here's my point. That information is trade secret information. In order to get access to that information, there's going to have to be a trusted third party that the party who holds the portfolio is willing to sign an exclusive proprietary agreement with. I can't talk about any more about the depth of that because the people we need to be able to talk to are the brand holders and about whether they're willing to disclose that information. I do know it's going to have to be treated like trade secret information, and all information will have to be anonymized. But I think we'll learn some important things, and we may learn what essential additional IPR protections are needed and where they have to be applied.
Just before we run off, Marilyn, can you just clarify for me what question you're asking the brand holders there? So certainly it's generally public information as to what names most brand holders have because the who is public, so we know what they have. So are you really asking the question on what they're going to do with those names? Is that the question you're asking?
No, I think if you were to look at the Analysis Mason report that I worked on Mark Monitor, we did develop a list of questions. When you don't just ask in order to understand the issues here, because you know people are using the word switching costs, but that's not really the right term here. We need to think about this as portfolio management and defense cost, okay, right? Yeah. And there's also the brand enhancement, marketing of the brand. But right now we're talking about managing a portfolio and defending it. And I think we all understand that trademark holders have to protect their brand. This is not like a copyright. They have to protect their brand or run the risk of losing it and dilution. So when you're managing, and there are people who are much more expert than me, my experience in this is a few years old, when you're managing a portfolio, you have to make sure your registrations are renewed. You have to look for cyber squatting. You have to take defensive actions against people who are harming your brand, or you may need to recover certain registrations that have been registered for whatever reason as either cyber squatting or they're registered to harm you or to dilute your brand. So the whole management process, Bruce, is very broad. So let me give you an example of where we add a negative network externality to someone who must defensively register. If all of the defensive processes we establish, such as sunrise or whatever, if they're individualized because somehow we think that adds competition between the registries, I would question that. But if that's individualized, then the brand holder has to individually train on not just one, but 2 or 10 or 15 or 20 processes. And it's that adds cost. So it isn't just that you're training someone to manage a new process, but you may be training people to manage multiple processes that are not consistent. That adds cost in the management of a portfolio. Does that make sense? So when you ask a brand holder, what are the mechanisms you use, you also need to ask them what the implication, what the additional cost factors are,
right,
based on their approach. Some brand holders use aggressive defensive approaches, others don't.
Anthony Vancouver with Minds and Machines. I'm afraid Marilyn just stepped into an area I know a little bit about in the past. And I think it's very important to distinguish between costs that are imposed by, say, GTLDs and ICANNs, and costs that are imposed by a company's cost structure. I've certainly heard a number floating around that it's going to cost $300,000 per GTLD for brands. That either means they have a portfolio of 30,000 names that they're paying market price for, or they have a much lesser portfolio they're paying way too much for. I mean, I certainly don't think it's incumbent on everyone to subsidize overpriced internal processes. So I urge people to bear that in mind when we talk about costs. Since this is about the economic study, I'd also like to take issue with the fact that there's any new information here. I don't think that there's anyone is going to be surprised to learn that museum didn't work. And we know that it didn't work because it has very restrictive policies. I'd also like people to keep in mind that prior to this round, the names chosen were chosen by ICANN. There is a difference between .com and .ugly. You know, there's a semantic difference between names. Now we have the chance at last to let people who understand their markets choose names that are attractive to their customers. The economic report talks about .com and .biz and how if truly there were competition to .com, someone would just choose a .biz instead. They are not equivalent. And in fact, that name was not chosen by Neustart. That was not their first choice. They would rather have had another one. And I think that we need to bear in mind that we cannot predict what's going to happen entirely, but we should not rely on economists who also cannot predict what's going to happen. Thank you.
I'm just going to interrupt for a second and give Vonda and Steve the opportunity to head off to their to head off to our meeting. So thank you very much, Vonda.
Thank you. Sorry about
that. Yeah. Michael?
Sure. Thank you. One of the things, and I appreciate ICANN for investing the resources, upwards of $2 million for these reports/studies. Following up on one of the points I made earlier today, it would really help if ICANN could explain what they picked and choose from the different reports, because they don't all say the same thing. So one of the things, I know I sound like a broken record here, but part of the affirmation of commitments about providing the decision process is really critical here. So one of the things I think both the community as well as I think the GAC is looking for is to explain what ICANN agreed with and where they deviated, because there are points of agreement and disagreement in this list.
So Mike, just because Kurt's just raised this question for me as well, you are ICANN. And so really when we're talking about which bits are picking and choosing from reports, this is the ICANN community. So what we'd like to hear from you is what bits do you think are relevant in those reports? You know, the board's not miraculously jumping in there and picking something out. We're listening to you. So this is a forum not to, you know, ask us. We've already had the session on accountability and transparency. So perhaps focus on specifically what bits of the reports you think are worthy, and we're interested to hear what others think as well.
Mindful of the time, I don't want to take up too much time. I will just go back to the one point that I had raised earlier specifically. In the original Cray report, the Cray economist said there was an inefficiency for a brand TLD to have to buy a name from itself through a registrar. They mentioned the inefficiency in that model. Now, Kurt had said at the time, well, it's rather complex and, you know, you deviate it because you're still mandating the use of registrars. So I would point that as one specific, and I could go through and identify a number of other points along those same lines. So I will try to get that in during the public comment period so that the board could reference that. The second follow-up point is I know that this is not an exact science. I appreciate that, and I was where you were at right now. I know it's a difficult job, and you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. The strength of ICANN is the strength is also its greatest weakness, right? You rely upon the bottom-up consensus-driven process. But unfortunately, there are sometimes economic interests that impede the ability of reaching consensus, which places the board in a very awkward situation. And I submit to you that your greatest ally in defending your actions is the GAC. And one of the things in the vertical integration where the CAM proposal that was written by myself, Avra Doria, and Milton Mueller, which the board adopted many of the proposals, one of the things that you build upon was the ability to refer matters to national competition authorities. So after the ICANN board details how it relied upon these different studies, giving this to the GAC that do have, if you will, competition authorities. In fact, the .com contract the last time got referred to the U.S. Competition Authority for review. I think there are ways that you can utilize the GAC to validate your decision, and I think it won't cost you millions or hundreds of thousands of dollars to do this additional work. So, again, I am all about the bringing a responsible closure to this process, and just would like to make those points. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, Michael. Mr. Footy?
Hello, gentlemen, ladies. The point about the limitation on the number of new GTLDs at 1,000 per year, it really is irrelevant because it applies for just this application period. As a result, we've got to be anticipating an unlimited number of GTLDs. As a consequence, the preeminent domain will no longer be .com, which, if your proposal with regards to .xxx goes ahead, is going to be tarnished as a cesspit anyway. People will look away from .com and they'll look at what the future will be. And when they see every major corporation with its own .tld, something that's heralded with .canon's application, they are going to be deciding to go for the 185,000 TLD rather than any other secondary domain. The board has, so far, you haven't done a single economic study of the impact of a massive million name top-level route. You have got to do that. The report by Dennis Carlton in 2009, it was done before even the number of GTLDs that were expected was even released. The second report last year, the first stage of this latest economic report, it didn't address the possibility of a top-level domain system replacing the .com domain. And that has got to be done. And you will see that what is going to happen is that we're going to replace .com, where somebody can get a presence on the Internet for $10, with something that costs $1 million, at least $1 million for the first TLD. You know, the second TLD will be $185,000, if that, because, you know, the people are saying, look, you've already carried out the work, you've already vetted us, so we want a discount on that. So the more GTLDs a corporation applies for, the cheaper it becomes.
So meanwhile, So what's your do you have a specific recommendation for board members to take back?
My specific recommendation for board members is that based on the fact that you're wanting to improve competition, to recognize that the introduction of new GTLDs has got to be done in such a way that it doesn't replicate .com, that it doesn't replace it. It's got to be complementary to it. What you have to do is, and I suggested this morning that, that the easiest thing to do would be to say, look, big, you know, the biggest 1,000 population cities in the world each get a .tld. Now, the reason that would make sense is that it would, first off, it would offer the ability to test what is going to happen. Secondly, it gives a global awareness to changes in the domain name market. You know, so people become immediately aware that there are changes going on. Thirdly, it gives a global incentive to develop the sort of infrastructure that is going to be necessary if more GTLDs are required in the future.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Yes?
Hi, Fred Krueger. I just want to make a brief comment. So my first comment is we shouldn't be calling these things economic studies. Because we're not studying something. We're not studying a colony of ants to try to see where what direction the ants walk in. This is economic prediction. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about, please have some economists come up and tell us what the world's going to look like 2 years from now. Now, can any of you, can any person in this room tell me what the Dow Jones is going to be 2 years from now? Can anybody tell me what the dollar euro is going to be 2 years from now? Can anybody tell me how many registrations .music will have 2 years from now? No economist, no person in this group, and none of this evidence, none of this data, which I have studied probably more than anybody in this room. I've studied every single WIPO case. I've looked at all the data, and we've seen all the data, and there is no new data. There is no new information. We have these existing TLDs, which are now 5 years old. There's no new information. You can't study these things and come up with new stuff. You have to make predictions. You have to make assumptions about the future. And guess what? We're all wrong. Russia thought they would get 100,000 names. They got 600,000. Colombia thought they'd get 100,000 names. They get 600,000. That's reality, okay? The reality is we have absolutely no idea which one of these things is going to be successful and which ones aren't. I can guarantee you that a lot of smart people in this room, using their own money, are betting on the fact that this stuff will be successful. I think that's the best single test of the new TLD program. Why people like Constantine are coming here for 2 years running and spending his own money sponsoring this event, he thinks .music is going to be successful. And I think it will. So I think that is the ultimate test of the new GTLD program. I'm sorry, Marilyn, you're wrong. Thank you.
Kurt, it's Steve DelBianco with NetChoice, also a member of the business constituency. So the question you've put to us is what's new that came out of this study and how it should impact the guidebook and the decisions that have to be made. And I believe that the economists did their best to answer a question, not to predict the future, but ask the question, do they believe that the benefits would exceed the costs of the new program as designed? And that's a rather pointed question, and as Fred said, it's rather difficult to answer. The economists concluded tentatively that new GTLDs will have a benefit that exceeds their costs, but on page 39, here's, I guess, the new information, quote, but if the new GTLDs fail to have adequate trademark protections, then infringement rates and cyber squatting costs could rise significantly. So it thinks that on balance there's positive, but if the RPMs are inadequate, costs would rise significantly, which throws into question whether or not costs would exceed or match benefits. So this is hard to use as a gating factor to say don't proceed, but it does point to new information in here that argues for enhanced rights protection measures, especially with the clearinghouse, and I believe that the BC will post its specific edits on that, specific changes today. That's number one. And number two is something we discussed this morning, Kurt, with respect to a more controlled release at the delegation phase, because it's very different than the batching. I don't want to confuse it with batch, because batch is with respect to evaluation and extended evaluation of apps. But when it comes to putting them into the route, this notion of doing initial delegations at a relatively low quantity with time to evaluate whether the RPMs have to be adjusted. I think that's the word we used this morning. Adjusting RPMs on the basis of experience of how that clearinghouse or claims service works on the first few delegations. So I don't want to call it a batch because that'll confuse everyone, but think of it as a bucket then, a bucket of water that we throw out there before we turn on a fire hose that's going to drown any chance of achieving effective safeguards we're obliged to provide.
So how would you prioritize those? I mean, that's a reasonable concept.
Bruce, let me ask you, absent any prioritization, how would the first delegated TLD be determined? I think it's the first one that's finished. Is that correct?
Well,
and if the first one's finished and you say the first 10...
Some of it's in control of the applicant and some of it's in the control of ICANN. So if you looked at the 2004 round, some of them still haven't gone live. .post hasn't gone live, for example, and that was approved last year. So the actual rate at which they went live was really determined in many cases by the applicant themselves and their own processes. So that they set the timetable. I was hearing from you that you're implying that we would somehow say, actually... this week we're only going to take 10 and then we have to decide which of the 10 they would be. I'd just maybe clarify what you mean by... There is going to naturally be a delegation rate that will vary over time.
Right.
And I think you'd probably find the gap... Even if you go back to the 2000 round, like Biz and Info didn't go at the same time. Yeah, there was actually a pretty big spread even in the 2000 round of those going live. So I think there would naturally be a spread and you will naturally see that. But I just want to clarify, were you assuming that we would then say we're going to pick you and you and let you go first?
Here's what the decision we have to make as a community. When the first TLDs are delegated and are ready to turn on, others should not turn on until you have a chance to do what you promised to do this morning, to evaluate and tweak the RPMs, to make sure that we have effective safeguards, which is our obligation. I think the economic study gives us new information that the balance between costs and benefits is positive but could be thrown the other way. That's one piece of new information. Another piece of information is staff's suggestion, and I agree with them, that we have to tweak the RPMs after they're turned on.
Yeah, but so then that's how the program is designed. The program's designed that we actually are doing a round in 2011, and then we evaluate that round before we open up for another round. So that is built into the process.
But Bruce, you can't do an entire round of several hundred TLDs to fix the RPMs.
That's what you're disputing. You're saying a round is too big.
I'm saying that as soon as the first TLD of the 2011 round is in the route and turned on, to your point, it's delegated but maybe not active yet because they're not taking registrations. But as they're taking registrations, going through sunrise period and TM claims, we are undoubtedly going to learn we didn't get it perfect. And I don't want to let the perfect be the enemy of the good. We're not saying don't proceed. We're saying proceed carefully and using testimony, I think, and that's been delivered here at this meeting, that we all have to adjust the RPMs, trademark claims, sunrise, clearinghouse. We'll have to adjust them as we use them in experience. And it doesn't make any sense to adjust and do our learning with a simultaneous turn on of hundreds of TLDs. We're going to have to actually have one or two go out. Maybe they're the first two that are done and ready. I'll leave it to the community to figure out that priority. But it's clear that this economic study points to the need to get that right.
So sadly,
yes. Oh, I'm sorry.
Hello. I just want to make one comment. I'm not sure, Steve, that's new information. I'm far from articulate in all these economic studies, but I can tell you that it's not news that the potential cost to trademark owners are going to be huge. And I think that the board has recognized that for a while now, which is why we formed an IRT in the way we did, right? We formed an IRT, actually, that wasn't as cross-community as some would have liked because we wanted trademark experts to come and try to propose some protection solutions, people that knew what their individual cost structures were going to be like to try to give us some real valid solutions that would work.
If I might follow up to be clear, I didn't say it was new information that trademark protection costs would be huge. I didn't say that at all. I said that the economists' new information is that they think benefits exceed costs, and they go on to say that those costs could be far more significant than they estimated if the trademark protection measures are not adequate, which is what they're saying is that the answer to the question, do costs exceed benefits, do benefits exceed costs, the answer to the question is, well, we think benefits exceed costs, but it depends. And that, I think, is new information, not the magnitude of the costs, but the balance between costs and benefits.
So, Steve.
Thank you, Kurt.
We're starting with the period where we have to make comments a little terser. So I want to hear, of course, we're going to hear.
I'll be as terse as possible. Yes. I'm Steve Metalitz. I have two questions. The first is to Kurt. Kurt, you said at the I was happy to hear that the economic study, the one at the top there, is now up for public comment. It's not on the up for public comment on the ICANN website yet, but can you tell me what the closing date of the public comment will be?
No, we're trying to sort that out. So the board is going to take comment here, and we're going to discuss the path forward. So
you can't say whether it's going to be before or after December, before or after Friday?
I can't because it's not my call. I have an opinion for that. So it is posted for comment on the ICANN website.
It wasn't 15 minutes ago, but maybe that's my problem. Yeah.
No, it's go to the where the new GTLD
I know
is
it's
posted,
but to say there's a public
there is the intent, whether it's available 15 minutes ago or not, but be absolutely clear, because I saw a message this morning. I saw a directive to staff to create a public forum for that economist report. I can't tell you what's available this second, but it certainly that is the intent. Yeah.
And what was the expiration date on the public comment forum in the directive that you saw?
Yeah, it doesn't have a closing date yet.
It doesn't have a closing date?
No.
Well, my next question was assuming that there was a closing date and that it might be after Friday, but let me proceed on the assumption that there is going to be a closing date and that it will be after Friday. I recognize that may not prove to be true. The report states in paragraph 3, in principle, projections regarding external costs could be used to design application screening policies or to guide the design of policies to reduce the magnitude of any external costs associated with a new GTLD. So I guess I'd like to ask the board members on the panel, do you think that that by Friday, assuming that the public comment period is not closed and that there is a public comment period, that you will have enough information from that public comment process in order to decide whether to use that principle and to use projections regarding external costs to design application screening policies or to guide the design of policies to reduce the magnitude of external costs. Do you think you'll have that enough information by Friday?
Steve, I really have no idea. I don't. I hear what you're saying. I was not aware this is posted with no outside date. I think that we're going to rely on staff to get information this week and present it to us, and we have to just play it by ear. I have no idea.
Okay, and I guess I don't want to put the other board members on the spot here, but I would submit that the time period between whenever last Friday night this was posted and whenever next Friday morning you sit down to decide on this issue is not sufficient time for public comment that will allow you to consider whether what is in this report should be followed. And I'm not, obviously you're not bound to follow it. I do think that if you don't follow it, you're bound to explain it. And I don't think you're going to have a chance to do that with a public comment period that effectively ends on Friday. Thank you.
I'm sorry, can I just clarify one thing? The report is for public comment under the guidebook dedicated page. It was not posted as a standalone yet.
So it's Friday.
My name's Paul Stahura, and I got a couple comments regarding what you said, Bruce. Things to point out in the report. And regarding what Steve Del Bianco said, too. I want to point out that the report did say that the benefits exceed the costs. And at least my understanding, and I think pretty much everybody in the room would say that more trademark infringement, more defensive registrations happen in .com than other TLDs like .info and .biz and the new TLDs, even though they both have the same rights protection mechanisms. So you have to ask yourself, well, they have the same right protection mechanisms. Why does one have more defensive registrations than the other one? And I think it's because that one has more traffic, so there's more squatters trying to get the traffic, and so therefore there's more defensive registrations trying to prevent the squatters from getting the traffic. Which leads me to another point in the report that said a benefit to the trademark holders for defensively registering is the fact that they get the traffic. I think there was like half a sentence in the report about that. And that has to be taken into account when you do the equation to figure out which, you know, whether the benefits exceed the costs. And so, you know, we had the IRT, which came up with even more rights protection mechanisms than what we have in .com and these other TLDs, where there's, you know, a differential between trademark defensive registrations in common and in these other TLDs. And so, you know, I sort of agree with Del Bianco, but I also disagree with him. I agree that if we had more rights protection mechanisms, obviously the costs might go down for the trademark holders. But if we have less, even the cost might go up, but they might not, still might not exceed the benefits. And so I do agree with them that if we had more, the costs would go down, but if we had less, they wouldn't, still might not exceed. And if we did a test, let's say, with the first couple TLDs that come out in the new round, and we find out, first, that will take a long time. So we got to wait a year or something to figure out, well, this brand new TLD, the first one out, does it have enough? How many defensive registrations did it get? What happened with the rights protection mechanisms? That's too long to wait. But I would guess that that one probably won't. It'll be just like the .infos and the .bizs and the .museums, and it'll have even less defensive registrations because we have more rights protection mechanisms because of the IRT, and it doesn't have as much traffic as .com, so it'll have less because of that. And so my question would be to Del Bianco would be, what happens if there's less trademark defensive registrations? Does that mean we dilute the rights protection mechanisms? Do we make less of them? And I would say yes, it would, if, you know, if we were to run this quote test. But I think we did enough studies. This is like the fourth study. I think this, you know, let's move on. This is enough studies, and the rights, the benefits exceed the costs. And anyway, that's all I have to say. Rights, the benefits exceed the costs.
So I'm not the time czar, but we're kind of out of time for this session. So if everybody who's going to comment could take 1 minute and comment. And Amadeo, that doesn't mean you get to talk faster than usual. And Michael, you've already made a comment. So if there's a way you could pin your comment for the comment form, that would be terrific. Because we're already over time on this topic, and I have two topics to go.
Okay. Just one small question regarding the studies. And not to point something that's there, but something that's missing. We're talking about competition, about positive and negative externalities, benefits and costs. I miss some analysis of what has happened. I mean, I see nowhere which portion of .cat or .asia or the name zone was already in .com before being registered there. And how many of that are the same registrants or not? This is something that's not that difficult to check and would provide us some ideas about differentiation and competition, and we could see different trends and analyze the different policies, the different meaning, and learn things about that.
So Amadeo, I would classify you as an expert in .cat. What's your gut feel? An interesting question. Of the names in .cat, how many of those are in also .com?
We never check. I just ask the people managing .cat. They never check. We should. But I can shoot. What I know, for instance, for that case, for the first year after Sunrise, 31% of the registrations came from people that never had registered a domain name before, which is quite significant. This is also something that can be done. You can also take for infringement just 50 random names for each TLD and the first 50 that Google provides inside semicolon dot and see whether they, you know, appear to represent something that you would expect on that TLD, or the ratio between names in the zone and conflicts, be that with your other type of conflicts, even the simple metrics that could be then mapped into different probably patterns of policies and registry behaviors. We miss that, and I don't think this is that complex.
Carla has a couple comments to read, so if you could just read them.
This is Carla Valenti from STEF. I'm speaking on behalf of the chat room. We have about 45 to 51 participants in the chat room. So one of the questions is, why haven't the comments in the public periods for economic studies ever been summarized by the STEF? The comment periods closed April 09, July 09, July 10, respectively. There were issues mentioned in the public comments that introduced issues of massive potential cost implications for different types of new GTODs. Does the staff plan to summarize these comments before the board votes on Friday? Second question.
So just for the information, the plan is for the economists themselves to summarize and analyze the comments, and don't think it's for staff's role. I know myself that the economists read those comments when they wrote their second version of the report, but have not yet done the comment summary.
Okay. And second question, even the latest reports look at very narrow selected subset of very obvious problems with the proposed GNSO new GTOD implementation. For example, what happens if Microsoft secures .search? How does Google or any startup search provider, for that matter, feel about it? Microsoft may be happy to allow Google to register Google.search if they can point video.search and news.search to Bing. We can look at this potential problem further. So I just want to make a point that there are more questions in the chat room, but because of timing, what I'm going to do is I'm going to send all of those questions to the board today.
Just a quick comment on someone's earlier comment about iterating within a round. We're on round three. We iterate between rounds one, two, and round three. We should iterate before round four, not within a round. So we don't put info out and iterate before biz. But I want to talk about economics, and I want to talk specifically about something that showed up in the new applicant guidebook, or the final applicant guidebook, or the temporary final applicant guidebook, or whatever we call it, which is there's a chart in the middle of it that says ICANN now wants 3 years of operating revenue, projected operating revenue, held in escrow for all applicants. So, you know, I can do the back of the paper math that says, look, it's going to cost a few hundred thousand to run a proper registry. So now you want, let's say it's 400,000. Now you want 1.2 million given to you to hold an escrow in case we fail, as opposed to letting me take that money and spend it on actually making sure I don't fail. So I'm kind of curious as to the rationale of where did 3 years come from. There's no option around it. It's either letter of credit or cash on the barrel held to be held in escrow. I think you're laming people. Like, everybody is commenting about the 185 grand needed to get there without realizing, hey, now you need 3 years of whatever you think you're going to do held in escrow again. So kind of maybe, Kurt, if you can comment on where that came from. And just before I leave, I would like to say I'll answer the person's question about the Dow Jones in this way. Dot Music's going to have zero registrations in 2 years. I'm sorry, but he's got 4 months of advertising, 18 months of auctioning and everything else to get through with communities and auctions, 90 days of signing up registrars. So let's not kid ourselves. If we don't get moving, the problem is in 3 years he'll still have zero. So we've got to move.
Yeah, so Rob, that's that 3-year requirement's been in the guidebook for quite some time. It's not 3 years operating revenue or even operating expenses, but it's for the registry to secure a note that will assure that certain core functions of the registry will continue to operate in order for the in order to protect registrants, either to find the successor registry operator or provide for an easy landing. But it's been in the guidebook since the start. Well, it depends on the model of the registry. So it's not really the topic of this conversation, and we can take it offline.
Elaine Pruis. I just wanted to maybe bring some information to this room that might be new to some people. The .co registry relaunch utilized several of the recommended rights protection mechanisms, such as a clearinghouse. And I thought it would be interesting if Steve would like to see if that was useful or how it worked. He could talk to them, and maybe it would be interesting for the board to check with the director of that registry. Thanks.
Wendy Seltzer, I'll be very brief, just noting the volume of economic studies and the tremendous work that the board has done in reaching out through its staff to commission those studies. I think the board has done substantial economic diligence here, and it's time to move forward.
Just a quick comment on the .co comment, just to provide perspective. I guess the rights protection mechanisms have been continuously evolving really since 2000, and not just by GTLDs but also CCTLDs. So, you know, .eu, for example, used many of the lessons learnt from .biz and .info. Subsequent TLDs like .asia use lessons learnt from .eu, and .co is obviously the latest fairly large registry release, along with the Cyrillic version of Russia, and both of those have used a lot of these rights protection mechanisms. So we're not really going from no information, but it is true some of the new mechanisms are still untested, such as URS and other things, but it is a continuous improvement process.
Thank you. It's Philip Shepherd. I'd just like to correct some nonsense we heard earlier about defensive registrations, which was correctly or incorrectly quoting what was in the studies. Defensive registrations are all about the protection of reputation. They're nothing to do with traffic. A defensive registration is a TLD you do not want but are forced to pay for by somebody else's business model. We may yet be seeing defensive applications for top-level TLDs. These are also TLDs you do not want but you're forced to pay for because of somebody else's business model, and in this case, you're forced to pay for an enormous amount of money. Defensive registrations, defensive applications are money down the drain of other businesses because businesses outside of their business area want a commercial opportunity. Let's be very clear about that. That is why they're a bad thing, and that is why we have, and we're trying to have, all these protection mechanisms in order to stop that externality happening. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, everyone. If the board members and all of you think it's okay, there's two more topics. One is trademark protections, and one is malicious conduct, and they're loosely related, although very separate. So what I'd like to do, because we have 50 minutes left, is 5-0, is combine those two talks and invite comments on one or the other. So what I'd invite, when you come to the microphone, describe whether you're commenting on an augmentation to rights protection mechanisms or malicious conduct mitigation measures or both. So that would be great. And I think these issues are fairly well vetted with this audience. So I'm going to just briefly point to the slides that the development of trademark protections involved critical collaborators in the community, especially experts in the IP and business constituencies, and then the entire GNSO and at-large representatives. Several documents were published that resulted in the specific measures in the guidebook that have if you look at the life cycle of the registry, we have pre-launch mechanisms that are operated through the clearinghouse, trademark claims, and Sunrise. One of those two is mandatory for every registry. And then post-delegation, the uniform rapid suspension process, post-delegation processes for finding registries liable if they're actively engaged infringing behavior and thick who is. Other suggestions have been GPML blocking at the second level, greater registry liability for registrant acts. When you come to the microphone, we'd ask you to discuss specific changes to the current set or suite of protection mechanisms. With malicious conduct, likewise, there were critical collaborators in this. There is an HSTLD advisory group, also a zone file access advisory group that each developing or have developed a set of protections against malicious conduct. The high security TLD group is seeking to create a voluntary program for registries that want to certify themselves or hold themselves out to registries that they're high security zones. The ZFA group collaborated and delivered a product that's in the guide group to ease access to zone file data. And both these things have manifested themselves in guidebook amendments that are in the current version of the guidebook. Very briefly, the malicious conduct mitigation measures are here. There's actually a last one that's not included in this slide that the current registry agreement now has a code of conduct for registries to protect against data abuses. So this list that's been published in many meetings is republished here, plus the last one. And other suggestions really have been considered and identified as policy issues. So maybe the work going forward is policy related, but elimination of privacy and proxy services, registrant verification, who is accuracy obligations, who is searchability. There was another suggestion there, and it went away. Oh, there's another thing that can be done that we're undertaking now to make who is data more internationalized, so we can accurately account for different scripts in the who is database. So that's one other suggestion that's been suggested. So the comment so far in this meeting has been really good, and I'd ask the audience to come to the microphone and comment on the suite of trademark protections, malicious conduct mitigations, what could be changed or improved, what additional work should be done. So I kept that really terse on purpose, recognizing the knowledge here in the room and wanting to make time for everybody.
Hello, Kurt. I'll speak to malicious conduct, and I currently serve as the chair of the High Security Zone TLD Working Group. And Rita, as you're aware, on the Board Governance Committee, I currently have an outstanding reconsideration request in connection with some board actions taken in connection with that. I guess what I would just ask for is for ICANN to allow the HSTLD group to finish our work. We are currently right now in the middle of an RFI process. We had a call last week or 2 weeks ago with a number of accountancy firms that would seek to be participating in an RFI process to participate in the validation type program. We have worked with ICANN staff, and it is our intent to have a report available by the second week of February, which would allow it to be published within the acceptable time frame in advance of the March meeting. So from that standpoint, we would just like to be able to finish our work, and it was a little awkward to, if you will, respond to some of the participants in the middle of an open RFI period when the board basically said we don't want anything to do with it. So again, if ICANN's committed to the bottom-up process, if you could just let the bottom-up process finish our work before taking action, it would really be appreciative. And again, I in many of my comments here today, I've talked about the responsible closure of this process. I really want to help bring about that closure. There's a right way and a wrong way, and it's just some of these awkward steps like what you see with Steve Metallitz of when it's opening and closing that just really makes it awkward, and Just want to wrap things up responsibly. Thank you.
Mike, just maybe just elaborate a little bit further for me regarding the bottom-up process, but perhaps just summarise very quickly what the outcomes of the HS TLD are and when you're going to run it through the GNSO, because I assume, are you creating a policy around high secure zones? I'm interested when you say bottom-up process, because I haven't seen it come through the GNSO at all.
Well, it was ICANN that asked for this. So under it was ICANN right. itself, and the ICANN board okay. is allowed to ask for the creation of policy. So
sure.
it's not like a bunch of people got together and said, let's follow Mike.
Right.
ICANN said, step forward, take responsibility. We did that, and from Seoul until approximately Brussels, we met every week. We had a weekly teleconference. Right. Actually, for a three-month period of time, we actually had double calls to advance some of the control elements. So we were acting in response to a request by ICANN to solve one of the outstanding issues.
Okay. We'll take it offline because I'd like to understand the request a little bit more. But, you know, I'd be happy to meet with you this week to understand the context, particularly your process context. But, you know, I certainly don't think it's accurate to say that the board said go away and don't do anything.
Well, I guess, Bruce, and I will not repeat what's in my reconsideration request, but when we talk about asking, again, going back to the affirmation of commitments and asking for an explanation, in the resolution you cited legal concerns. And what was incredibly, shall we say, out of the blue, as the chair of the group, legal concerns had never been raised at any point in time. When I read the briefing papers that were made available, there was no reference to legal. So again, as someone in the community that sees, you know, from Mount Olympus, the resolutions come down, whereas, resolved, when you see we're not doing this because of liability concerns, now, to staff's credit, General Counsel and ICANN did engage in a call after the fact in trying to get a feel for how we might be able to address those legal concerns. And one of the things that the group is evaluating right now is what ICANN has done in connection with the UDRP. ICANN created the policy and has accredited people such as NAF and WIPO to administer it. So there are options, and not having the ability to understand the decision is what's so frustrating. And I think that's what you hear a lot of, not, you know, again, you hear, I think, this frustration from some of the people here, probably more so in the GAC is where you're hearing a lot of this frustration. And again, it's just people that want to help bring a responsible closure to the process. Thank you.
Philip?
Thank you. It's Philip Shepherd speaking on behalf of the business constituency. Kurt, I mentioned to you in the informal sessions we had yesterday that we had a document in process which answers a whole range of issues to do with the new TLDs and application guidebook, and this beautiful 16-page document will be with you shortly. In the meantime, relevant to today's discussion, let me just summarise a couple of things to do with rights protection mechanisms in the paper, which I think are pertinent. The first thing to say, I think, is that we are disappointed by ICANN's continued disregard of its stated concerns about effective rights protection mechanisms. The final guidebook is proposing a substantially weakened version of the chapter of RPMs that were first discussed. You know, if this issue had been solved earlier, you'd be hearing from us in, you know, voices in the same direction saying, get on with it, we're fine, go
but
ahead
Philip,
with the release.
What's been weakened in the final guidebook?
Well, the next three. URS. URS is not going to be a rapid process. It's been shortened a little bit, but it is still not particularly fit for purpose. We've got more detail in this document which we'll send you, but essentially you've got problems in terms of its the possibility for a de novo review after 2 years of suspension. That suspensions are temporary. And it essentially is placing brand owners in a perpetual monitoring situation. Secondly, the trademark clearinghouse isn't really a clearinghouse, as it's a database. And unless within that and Sunrise we solve this issue in terms of getting the word right on use, either qualification of how to get a trademark in there, it also won't be fit for purpose. So, but again, as I mentioned to you yesterday, our suggested wording specifically on that issue is in this paper, and we think that will help very much. And it goes directly, I mean, the objective that staff were pursuing on this in terms of what trademarks qualify for it, how you do it, the objective the board were pursuing when it came up with its wording in the Norway meeting is exactly our objective. It's just that the phrasing to date is a little bit too specific for certain trademark regimes. And we have come up with some wording checked with global trademark experts, which we believe scales to different types of regimes. So you will have the specifics of that in this document. And
Philip,
the third issue.
Philip, sorry, has that paper been submitted to staff?
Yes, it will be. It's freshly approved. We had a vote on it, and the vote's just finished. So it will be with all of you as soon as Mr. Steve Del Bianco gets beavering on the email. And our third issue is the post-delegation dispute procedure, where we are concerned in particular about the high burdens of proof there at both the first and second level. Again, the details in the paper. So the essence of the message is it's all been moving, you know, in the right direction, but it's a bit like pushing a rock uphill. There are some fixes there which were described earlier, and if only we get those right, you know, we'll be on track, but we're not there yet. Thank you.
Thank you. Steve Metallitz again. My comment is on malicious conduct. Kurt, you were saying earlier today that wondering why people aren't commenting on the application, so I want to give you a comment on the application, especially Criterion 35, which requires that the applications have security measures that are appropriate for the applied-for GTLD string and also require a description of any augmented security levels or capabilities commensurate with the nature of the applied-for GTLD string. I think this is a positive step. There are, we've been saying for a long time that some GTLD strings, by their character, it's not going to be sufficient to have the minimum level of protections against malicious conduct that all the other new GTLD applications have to meet. I am kind of concerned, however, that this description of any augmented security levels or capabilities commensurate with the nature of the applied for GTLD string apparently is not going to be made public. And therefore, it will be very difficult for members of the public to provide any advice to the evaluators, even if those members of the public are knowledgeable about the types of protections that should be available for strings with unique trust implications, which is, again, the language in Criterion 35. So I guess my two points are, first, I think it would be very useful for ICANN to state specifically, I think it's implied here, that this criterion does not apply only to financial services-oriented strings, but there are many other types of strings with unique trust implications. And second, to make as much information as possible. I understand there, with security information, it may not be everything, but I think Bob Hutchinson talked about security by obscurity earlier this afternoon. I hope as much information as possible will be made available to the public, because basically what you're doing with this criterion is you're letting the public guide the evaluator as to whether there is the security protections are strong enough, rather than putting a positive obligation in there. So in order for the public to do its job, it's going to need more information than you currently plan to make public. Thank you.
So I just want to respond to that briefly in a comment by Bruce. And that, you know, we did receive advice that there were also good reasons for keeping, security type information confidential, so we didn't relay any security plans that could cause damage. So I think
there's probably a difference of what Steve means by security and what a technical person might mean by security. Like, when I talk about security, I'm not going to give you my crypto codes, but I don't think that's what you're asking. And what you're saying is that section is fairly broad, and you're saying, presumably, you're talking about things like what authentication checks are done and that sort of thing.
Yes, for example, someone might say, for my string that has unique trust implications, I'm going to require that registrants be verified.
Yeah.
or I won't require that. So that's what we would like to know, because we might be able to say for that kind of string it really should be.
And the comment this morning was exactly about certain types can be held confidential, but a lot of it should be made public. So it's the second comment in a row just like that.
Thank you.
Hi, Kurt. David Taylor. I have a declaration of interest to make. First of all, I was on the IRT. Secondly, I am a lawyer. And thirdly, I will benefit from a lack of rights protection mechanisms as a lawyer. So, personally, take them out. However, with my sort of more protection of consumers and trademark owners hat on, I do think that they're good and we need strong RPMs. And I won't go over the points which Philip just covered, but it was just to add to it as an example on the URS where we are today, in that it isn't rapid, it is redundant, because even with the 7 days taken out, you're looking at something which instead of going 47 days is 40, and the EU DRP is around 35 days. So it's quicker to file an EU DRP, or a UDRP if you like. So that's one thing. And the way it's gone now, where we've got 5,000 words to file in the complaint, if you give a lawyer 5,000 words, he will write 4,999 words. So this isn't the way we want to go. We should have less words in the response, to keep the fees down. And that was just basic points, but we could go through the other ones and we'll make comments.
Hi, Christina Rosette. Everything that David said about his declaration of interest applies to me as well. Some very specific suggestions on rights protection mechanisms. First, I think at this point, it's important to recognize that although the IRT had recommended only an identical match, we did so in the context of a much broader tapestry of solutions, which we did not anticipate or plan to have unraveled. And frankly, had we known that that would have happened, it is a virtual certainty that we would have recommended the broader match that you've now seen recommended and requested in the GAC's recent communication to the board. With regard to the URS, I'll just point out that in addition, hopefully it's poor drafting, but there's a section in there that essentially says that where the respondent does not respond and the examiner can conceive of any possible defense, then the respondent wins. And obviously, any creative lawyer is going to be able to think of any possible defense. And I think it's important to note that it should be any possible successful defense. Because otherwise you're going to have that exception essentially swallow up the utility of the mechanism. With regard to the trademark PDDRP, I'm not going to repeat the comments that Philip made, but I should just note that now that we are looking at a future of complete vertical integration, I would say that that's fine, but you can't have your cake and eat it too. So with regard to the trademark PDDRP, I think it needs to be revised to ensure that any registrar that is vertically integrated with a registry should have, in the event of a trademark PDDRP claim, the conduct of that registrar imputed to the registry. Finally, I would also note that with regard to the URS, as it's written, the owner of a trademark registration from any country other than the United States, Canada, Australia, and a few others that require evidence of use is first going to have to go to the Trademark Clearinghouse and go through that whole process to get their mark validated. And while that was an interchange that the IRT had suggested, we had also suggested that there be other efficiencies which have since been jettisoned. So on the one hand, you're adding increased burden without having the offset. Finally, I would just note that to the extent that I had understood Paul Stahura to say earlier that .com had the same rights protection mechanisms as .info and .biz, that is incorrect. .com did not have a pre-launch mechanism. Instead, we had a wonderful opportunity to write letters to network solutions and ask for holds and all the rest of it. And another way to look at UDRP, which I think a lot of people have not been and they should be, is that it's a very expensive way to essentially get a defensive registration. You can't file a successful UDRP complaint for under about $4,000, including the filing fee. And what you're going after are the names that, frankly, you didn't want in the first place, but you need to make sure that some cyber squatter doesn't have them and is using them to damage your brand. Finally, just following up on Elaine's suggestion, I think that's an excellent idea, although I would also note that .co implemented a variation on the globally protected marks list. So I think if we're going to compare apples to apples, we do in fact need to compare apples to apples.
Bina, why don't you give us feedback on how the CO process worked? I mean, that's what we're trying to learn from. So you presumably just experienced that. Did it work or was it useful?
The verdict is still out. There's certainly squatting in it. Although I think
specifically the GPML side of it, because that's something I know they implemented, but following the IRT report,
all of the clients that I work with that qualified for it handled it directly, simply to reduce the expense of having to do so. So I'm not in a position to, you know, they handled that internally. I think if you wanted to get in touch with INTA and see if they'd pass on an information request, that might be one way to do it. Do you have a question, Rita? Okay.
Kathy Kleiman with .org, and before I was with .org, I was on the STI. And I wanted to ask what happened to the 20-day notice period under the STI. That had been something that we had worked on a lot and spent many, many hours talking about. The reason why was basic notice to registrants and that they would have time to respond. Under the UDIHP, many registrants, those who respond, often respond very late in the day because it takes a while for the notice to get to them. So since the complainant holds the full ability to decide when to file, should they choose to file at the beginning of an August holiday for a European registrant, or before Christmas, with an individual registrant who might be on holiday for 2 weeks, there was a concern about notice, and also that 14 days, even if you have an extra 7 days, it's very hard to respond. It's very hard to find someone to assist you to respond. So I'd love to know what happened to that 7 days. Because we did build in so much behind that, including the very, very rapid decision that the panelist needs to make, the examiner needs to make. I wanted to note, just as a personal thought, with the GPML and .co, while I understand it did work well, I'm not sure it works very well. I mean, it might work well for .co and not for the vast majority of new GTLDs, with the non-commercial TLDs, with TLDs that may or may not have any overlap with .com. It's a different type of world, and I think it was a very wise decision to go with three of the IRT mechanisms and not the fourth. With my .org hat on, the PDDRP, I wanted to thank you for. I think it's gotten much better. We're talking about a challenge of a GTLD that may have hundreds, thousands, millions of registrants. And so the fact that there's now a threshold review, that there is an appeal, and also that there's a recognition of the equities, that the examiner is asked to consider the impact of the revocation of the TLD, not just on the registry, but on the registrants, unrelated registrants. I think all of these make it a much stronger and better proceeding, so thank you for listening.
Just a follow-up comment on this GPML and also the .co implementation of it. It is still open to put any of these things through the GNSO policy development process, and they become mandatory for not just new GTLDs but existing TLDs as well. So to the extent to which Christina's colleagues or INTA or .co itself can provide feedback to the GNSO saying, you know, this was great, you know, you should implement it widely, or this is why, you know, this is what went wrong and this is how we would improve it. I mean, that's really what the ICANN process is meant to do. So I wouldn't ever say that the door on these things is closed, and certainly something like that, if it was found to be successful in a recent TLD launch, should be, you know, maybe taken back to the GNSO, modified slightly, because ultimately if the GNSO approves it, the board will endorse it and it becomes mandatory. So I just wanted to highlight there's no sort of end date, really, that new policies and new procedures that get determined become policy development and become mandatory.
Kathy, I just have one follow-up. When the board was reviewing the URS, we understood that to be what it says, which is rapid suspension, and this was going to be for clear cases of abuse. So I think you're talking about having the period extended to some extent. We heard somebody comment, and I apologize, I can't remember who, that if you look at the time periods, you're basically longer than UDRP. So I just wondered what your thoughts were on that.
I'd welcome to hearing why they think it's longer than the UDRP. When we added it up, it was designed to be much faster than the UDRP, where if you have one panelist, if you have three panelists, often there's a fairly long time period for decisions. And we said, I think it was 3 to 5 business days. So the idea is to really, the panelist the examiner is really supposed to turn this around very, very quickly. And that was where the real time savings came from. Was enough notice to the registrant that if this goes into the ether, if it goes into their spam filter, you know, there's some way to kind of recover from that. But that fast decision, because it really should be an up or down, and that's how we designed the URS.
This is one of the things that we implement it, we see how it goes. Kathy, if we're finding a lot of instances where that's caused a problem, we'll adjust it. You know, again, these things are not locked in stone. We need to implement something. You can argue pros and cons, whether it's 14 or 21 days, but ultimately we need to implement it, then learn from it, evaluate it, decide whether it needs to be shorter or longer.
Thank you.
Bruce, do you want me to comment on the speed? I can just follow up on the speed point there. I mean, I can just take the example of the first EUDRP which we filed, which was for a case, NokiaSex.com. Clearly a bit of a problem for Nokia. That was 35 days from start to decision with WIPO. So that's the 35 days I'm quoting. Obviously, wait to see how long it gets on the URS.
Yes, hello. My name is Jonathan Zuck with ACT. And I know you brought up the issue of metrics surrounding new gTLDs, and that's going to come up, and I'll participate in this process. Sometimes knowing where to interject comments is a little bit like playing Marco Polo, I guess. But what occurs to me with a lot of things that come up here is that if we do some analysis of what has happened before and establish some baselines, that will both suggest metrics but also suggest deltas when we're trying to evaluate things. So, for example, really analyzing the amount of time that different complaints in the UDRP process, malicious conduct complaints, contract compliance. I mean, I've yet to ever hear a statistic out of the contract compliance department that I find useful. I mean, Kurt mentioned 16,000 letters went out. I don't even know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, frankly. So, I mean, doing a real statistical analysis of some of the existing UDRP procedures, some of the resolutions of malicious conduct, contract compliance, et cetera, I think will give us a baseline that we have something to compare to, whether the situation's made worse or improved upon, given the new mechanisms that are in place under the DAG.
Hello, this is Jeff Newman. I'm with Newstar, but I'm making this comment on my own behalf. If I went through my list of disclaimers of everything I am, from being a lawyer to being one of the founding members of the IPC, I'd probably be here all day. The comment I want to make, as one of the most vocal opponents initially on the post-delegation dispute resolution policy, I want to echo the comments made by Kathy that I really appreciate the work that's been done on that, and I really believe now it strikes the right balance. And to tinker with it anymore, I think, would be a disaster, would actually... I've seen the letter from the World Intellectual Property Organization asking yet again for the willful blindness standard, which is, again, I want to state before the board actually considers that letter again, that is a standard that would be greater than the rights they would enjoy under U.S. law. And I did a whole briefing on it. I sent it back with version, I don't know, DAG 2, 3, one of those. Just so before you take these new comments, please don't let them rehash arguments that have already been made and decided. Let's make sure it's new. And the new point, I want to actually thank Christina for the suggestion, and maybe it's in the paper that the BC will submit, but I do agree that now in a world with vertical integration, if it puts the post-delegation dispute resolution policy to bed, yes, add that in about the fact of holding a registrar, an integrated registry registrar, holding the conduct of the affiliated registrar against the registry. Great. If that's what it's going to take to close it, let's wrap it up, and let's get this thing started. You know, I was on the IRT, I was on the STI, commented left and right, but I think right now we've got everything we need to move forward and test it out. We have learned a lot of lessons from the past before. The IP claims, some have called me the father of the IP claims because, you know, we did it for .biz and I drafted it. There have been a lot of improvements on the IP claims process put in. I think we have learned. I think we have tested it out. It's been there. The sunrise, that's been tested out left and right. And Neustar is the back-end operator for .co, which everyone's been talking about. I'm not going to make any statements on behalf of it, but it worked. It was very smooth. There have been little complaints. The fact that no one had to pay Christina's law firm, I think that's great. I think they saved a lot of money, and I think it worked. Sorry for the lack of billables. Point is, I think we've come far enough. I think it's time to go. Let's test it out. Let's get it done.
Lee Williams with the Financial Services Community. For some time, we've been appealing to the staff and the board to require elevated security for financial services, generic top-level domains. In the current version of the applicant guidebook, we've seen language that was introduced that acknowledges that financial services has unique trust implications, lays it as an example of a domain set that would be expected to have commensurate levels of security. We see that language as absolutely responsive to our comments. We very much appreciate the fact that it's been built into the applicant guidebook. We wouldn't say that the issue is closed. We'd say that we now have codified in the rules the language that will allow us in the implementation stage to make that elevated level of security real. It's not a change or an improvement now that we need to the current approach. It's that we all need to do our part as we move forward in implementation to see that those advantages really are realized. A couple of comments earlier that Mike and Steve made about how the HSTLD advisory group is working and the confidentiality, I think, bear a little bit of underscore. HSTLD advisory group is one example of a group that is happy to invest its own time in pushing that security standard and giving us the level of specificity that we'll need for the evaluators to actually assess the applications as they come in. And we would urge the staff and the board to let HSTLD move forward, even if it is more independent than some might have thought a year or so ago. We think that it has real advantage in that process. There is also in the applicant guidebook the opportunity for industry-developed or industry-supported standards. Financial services, and I suspect other sectors, stand ready to develop those standards. And if we have either HSTLD or industry-developed standards that can be public, then applicants will be able to publicly commit to meeting those standards without having to detail every authentication or every encryption technique. They will be able to say, we've met the ISO standard, or we've met the financial services standard, or we've met the HSTLD standard.
I think that's really helpful, because if you look at a lot of the technical parts of the application, they're actually relying on IETF standards, which are done very similar way. So basically they're saying, you know, this needs to comply with such and such an RFC, this needs to apply to DNSSEC, this needs to apply to the IP version 6 standard. And I think if you're different industries, and I've had some other discussions this week with people from the pharmaceutical industry as well, I mean, I think if an industry sector can say this is the sort of standards we think need to be adhered to, and you have a way of saying that that's got industry support, I think that's very useful. And at the very least, you can submit that in the public comments on a particular application. So if someone applies for a particular name in your industry sector, you should say, you know, in this industry sector, this is the minimum standards that should apply, and the evaluators can then look at that. So, you know, I think that that's exactly right. It's a little bit of a difference between ICANN itself approving a particular industry standard. I mean, it could, but I think we envisage more that the external industry set standards, whether it's IETF or whether it's the finance industry, and then if it relates to different things, then that's something the evaluators would really be looking at, because each application has to define their security standards, and those standards need to be appropriate for the TLD they're applying for.
Wherever they might come from, if the applicants recognize them, and then the evaluators are able to take them into account.
Yep.
And ultimately, even the compliance group might look at them in post-delegation. All of that, we think, is an important way for the overall community to weigh in on security. So we would applaud the staff and the board for what we see as real progress in this area, and we'd urge you to invest continued resources in the implementation stage and to enlist all of us. Thank you.
Hi, Mark Lasik. Just a brief comment about the clearinghouse. I think there are some sections that need some tightening up in the drafting, specifically section 7.4 talks about verifying the absolute grounds of a registration, where governments do that, trademark offices do that. So you can come up with a decision that is contrary to what the trademark office has said.
So I don't see the need for Section 7.4, quite honestly.
So that's similar to another comment we received. Thanks.
So is that the idea? We'll take offline, yeah.
Do you got Bruce Reeder? So do you have any comments in closing?
Not really. I think this was helpful. The board's heard a lot of the comments of the community this week. We understand there's been some concern that the comments aren't going to be heard. We've been trying to iterate towards being more transparent in our decisions and listening to comments and hopefully bringing them to ground. So Bruce and I have been dutifully taking notes here, and we're going to go talk to the board. We have a workshop tomorrow, and we're going to try to address all of these. I don't think you're ever going to see something that comes back that says, you know, there was a comment on X, and this is why the board did not address that comment. But we're going to try as much as possible to give very clear idea to the community on any decisions that we make this week. So thanks for your feedback.
Thanks, Rita. Mr. Foody, we kind of wrapped.
Oh, sorry. I just had a couple of comments on this conduct.
What do you say, everybody?
Thank you. They're all on my side.
I don't know.
Okay, a couple of comments on malicious conduct.
One minute.
Well, I was speaking to Claudio from the IP, and he acknowledged that cyberbullying, where IP lawyers are going after innocent people, is a very real problem. So please keep your mind open to that possibility. Secondly, lawyers use the law sometimes to actually maintain things that are malicious. I've recently had a trademark application for Nosy, N-O-Z-I, turned down. Because they said, one, it looked like the word Nazi, which it does, because that was the reason why I applied for it. And secondly, it's being used by the London Olympic Committee was their reason for gagging me. As amazing as that might sound, some lawyer is using the law to stop me from publicising the fact that the London Olympic Committee have chosen the word Nazi as their logo. And this is, this is verifiable from the Canadian Intellectual Property Office. Thirdly, looking at the section 318, and it says the grounds upon which an applied for GTLD string may be considered contrary to generally accepted legal norms relating to morality and public order that are recognized under principles of international law are, and it includes incitement to or promotion of child pornography or other sexual abuse of children. In Canada at the moment, there's a public information advert talking about how the incidence of child pornography has multiplied by a factor of 10 in the last 10 years. Now, if ICANN does not take the opportunity to tie in .xxx with .com so that children, youths, are no longer subjected to that sort of thing, I think you're falling foul of your own rules.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Did you want to say anything? All right. So thank you very much for your time and for coming to the microphone and making very good comments. Notes have been taken, and you'll see them up in lights and carefully considered. So thank you very much.